start with the introductory stuff before our simultaneous translation machines come in. It's a pleasure for me to fill in at the very last minute and help start what promises to be a really lively weekend of events. And when I was taking the subway in from Brooklyn tonight, there was what I thought was a very good omen. There was a young woman on my subway car, the F train, reading a copy of Nadia by André Breton. And I think that's a pretty good illustration of the literary exchange that's already going on, and which as far as I would characterize it is France gives us novels that aren't really novels, and we read them with unquestioning devotion on mass transit. Okay, a little humor. We do have to wait a minute for our your pieces come, because we would like to hear Olivia behind. So we're going to do a little test here. Is there anybody translating for Olivia? Now is when the photographs are going off. Interesting. Is there anybody translating for Olivier? Oh, this is the English show. Are you hearing anything? Is it, are we working now? Okay, good. Thank you for your patience. I was especially interested in moderating this discussion because of the two distinguished writers it brings to the same stage, Olivier Flament and Yael Doctorow. Both are novelists of the highest order, with a deep concern for the public's practice that too often engages only our lizard brains, politics. They are writers, and they are citizens. In their distinctly civic-minded fictions, they explore the varying possibilities of how to serve the greater good, while still making uncompromised and uncompromising works of literature. In other words, how to write a socially committed novel that is free of ideological arm-twisting, no hoods, no stress positions. While I haven't had quite enough time to form a theory, I think that the solutions they have explored in their novels differ in ways that speak to their differing national origins. I'll slow down here. The French Republic and the United States. And this is one of the subjects I hope we can touch on in the next hour. In a nice bit of serendipity, the journal The Review of Contemporary Fiction published an essay by Flament in English translation last fall called The Subtle Art of the Novel. In it, Flament contrasts the good that literature seeks to foster in its readership with the good that politics promises for people, particularly the 1960s radicalism he was involved with before resigning himself. Thank you. Doctorow's work as I was reading this essay. So because of that, I thought I would use a few of the ideas in Olivier's essay to get the conversation going. And I'll start with one. Olivier, you make the following assertion to open your essay. Literature, particularly fiction, aspires to human freedom. It's worth repeating. Literature, particularly fiction, aspires to human freedom. Now you then proceed to spell out in the essay just how and why that is, and I really encourage anyone who hasn't read this piece to look for it. And one of the major reasons you give is that fiction asserts ambiguity as opposed to certainty and sloganeering. So I guess my first question is, in a very general sense, how does an art based in ambiguity serve the cause of freedom?
Well, first of all, I have to apologize because, as you have understood, I'm going to speak in French, even that my French is much more sophisticated than my English.
No. Ça marche.
You know,
ça marche.
The first panel always makes the big technological sacrifice. I think we're good.
So I say that first of all, I have to apologize because I'm going to speak in French. Given that my French is more sophisticated, a bit more sophisticated than my English. So, your question about fiction. Oui, c'est un art fondé. Moi, bon, je ne vais pas, on ne va pas se perdre dans des détails biographiques, mais le fait est que je suis venu, en ce qui me concerne, à l'écriture littéraire après des années, il y a longtemps, consacrées à l'action politique, disons, et politique radicale. Et si je suis venu vraiment, si je suis venu à cette à l'écriture, c'est parce que il m'a semblé que la seule manière de réfléchir à mon expérience, politique, et d'y réfléchir, étant donné l'incertitude de mes pensées, étant donné l'hésitation de mes pensées, eh bien finalement c'était la littérature. C'était la littérature qui était capable de rendre compte de l'hésitation, de l'incertitude de mes pensées. Donc ça a été ma première expérience de cette ambiguïté de la littérature, et je dois dire que cela a été aussi ma, d'une certaine manière, une guérison, enfin une rédemption, une guérison simplement. Parce que, en effet, je crois que tout discours politique, et là pas simplement les discours radicaux, sont des discours affirmatifs, sont des discours qui prétendent savoir où se trouve la vérité, où se trouve où se trouve l'erreur, qui prétendent savoir qui sont les amis, qui sont les ennemis, etc. Alors que le propre du discours littéraire, c'est justement d'éviter ces certitudes, de ne jamais pouvoir tomber dans ces certitudes. Il y a une phrase de... Il y a un tas de phrases qu'on pourrait citer à l'appui de ça. J'en citerai deux, disons. L'une qui est de Flaubert, et qui dit que l'une des plus, des pires maladies de l'humanité, c'est la rage de vouloir conclure, de vouloir arriver à une conclusion. Et que l'art, et la littérature notamment, elle ne conclut pas. Il y a une autre phrase que j'aime bien, les deux sont dans des, lettre d'ailleurs, une phrase de Dostoïevski qui dit que le plus grand personnage de l'histoire littéraire, c'est Don Quichotte, parce que Don Quichotte est à la fois sublime et ridicule. Voilà, qu'il est les deux à la fois. Et que le propre d'un grand personnage littéraire, c'est d'être, pas forcément sublime et ridicule, mais c'est d'être indéfinissable, d'être de ne pas se résumer à un seul aspect. Voilà, bon, donc la littérature, pour moi, c'est cela. Et comment est-ce que ça contribue à la liberté humaine? Bien, justement, parce que ça laisse... ça laisse tout le champ libre au jugement, ça laisse tout le champ libre à l'hésitation, à la liberté, oui, d'interpréter, de juger. Il y a aussi une phrase que j'aime bien qui dit cela, de Barthes, de Roland Barthes, qui dit le roman n'est pas le roman n'est pas impérieux, le roman n'est pas terroriste. Le roman ne nous dit pas ce que nous avons à penser. Le roman nous laisse penser ce que nous voulons. Donc, en cela, entre autres, il est un vecteur, un ferment de liberté.
So, if I can just simplify a little bit to turn the question to Edgar. It sounds like what Olivier is describing in part is a passage of disillusionment with the conclusions that political discourse comes to that allowed the opening to literature. And so in a sense, being a political being first and then being an artist. Is that something that happened to you? Or?
This is the sort of question that American writers don't really like to get into. But it is true that writers and politicians both understand that reality is amenable to any construction you place upon it. And that means that the politician looks at the writer with some distaste and weariness, and all over the world, it doesn't matter what kind of governments are running things, we see examples of writers who were jailed, exiled, otherwise punished, persecuted, because their version of the life around them is not the official version. So there's an automatic disconnect there, and writers do get into trouble. But the very broad history of the whole thing, of course, is it used to be that God was the writer. In the Bronze Age, authorship was restricted to God and his priests. And over time, with many revolutions and terrible events and a lot of slaughter, the right to authorship descended to the common man, and the Enlightenment was responsible for that, when people like Bacon and Galileo said, you've got to prove what you're saying to make it true. In the Bronze Age, from the age of the sacred texts, the mere act of telling a story carried a presumption of truth. Telling a story meant truth. And after the Enlightenment, that was no longer the case. So, in effect, writers have always been trying to reestablish their authority, and it's usually a lost cause. And today, it's only children who believe that the act of telling a story carries a presumption of truth. Children and fundamentalists that being said, the subject of books has become, through the novel, since the 19th century, has followed that path into kind of interior life of characters. So whatever the novel is, it necessarily carries a glorification of the idea of the self, and that is very democratic. What this has to do with freedom is apparent, but in societies where writers and journalists are published for having independent views of reality, the freedom is bought at a great cost.
Just a very quick follow-up on this question. You spoke of the right of authorship. Do you feel that's a natural right?
Well, it is a natural right if you can find a publisher. we have a certain piety in this country about writing fiction, that whatever ideas we have, whatever principles, whatever beliefs, they must come out of the work organically. Your mind, you cannot impress and hope to write something that lives. You cannot impress your politics on a book. I think Ms. Huberland would agree with that. It has to come out of the work. It has a kind of there's an integrity to the process of writing fiction that you cannot betray. You cannot scam. And and I think it was W.H. Auden said, a writer's politics are more of a danger to him than his cupidity. And so if you're going to do work that has a political subject, you have to be very careful to give every character in the book full justice. You can write a book with a great sense of anger, from a sense of justice denied in some case. But I think it was Bernard Shaw who pointed a valuable lesson for writers, that you always give the best lines to the person you disagree with. But what was your question?
I think you answered it much better than it deserves. So Lydia, in following up on what Edgar was just saying, do you, and I know a little bit from reading your work that's been translated and from reading the essay, which I'm focusing on because it's really one of those rare examples for a reader when a writer very much spells out kind of what their theory of fiction is. So it makes it very easy for me. But you write about a very, very similar ideas that Edward was just voicing about, the difficulties about writing about politics in fiction. And I wonder if it's something that you're aware of the dangers as you write about it, and perhaps you can give some specific examples of from novels that you read. The dangers of writing about politics. The dangers of falling back into your old self, like the local self, as opposed to the one who's resigned to literature.
Je ne sais pas, à vrai dire, je. Il me semble que j'ai toujours écrit des livres qui avaient quelques rapports à l'histoire, disons, et à l'histoire contemporaine, au monde contemporain, aux conflits, aux passions, etc., du monde contemporain. Mais en revanche, je ne crois pas avoir politique, donner une espèce de testament politique, etc., dans un livre. Donc, il me semble que le roman en France, et enfin, entre autres en France, c'est affranchi complètement, en tout cas à ma génération, de cette... cette illusion, enfin, ou en tout cas de cette illusion qu'il a à donner des leçons politiques. Qu'il a... Bon, je me souviens, tiens, oui, je parle de Roland Barthes. Bon, le cas de Roland Barthes est intéressant, par exemple, puisque à la fin de sa vie, disons, Roland Barthes était. Ce qui l'intéressait, c'était, au fond, c'était la beauté de la langue. C'était Pascal, c'était Chateaubriand. Mais au début de sa vie, il avait une conception beaucoup plus politique et qui maintenant nous fait rire, enfin moi me fait sourire. Je me souviens par exemple d'une enquête qui est apparue dans le Nouvel Observateur et le thème de l'enquête c'était qu'est-ce qu'une littérature de gauche ? Et qu'est-ce qu'une littérature de droite par opposition. Bon. Enfin, à vrai dire, déjà l'intitulé de la question, moi maintenant, me paraît assez, assez étrange. Et alors, Roland Barthes répondait qu'une littérature de gauche, c'était une littérature où l'on pouvait. Les personnages étaient pas simplement des individus, mais étaient représentatifs d'une catégorie sociale. Bon. C'est évidemment imbécile. Et comme Roland Barthes était tout sauf un crétin, cela veut dire qu'à certains moments de sa vie, une conception trop politique de la littérature l'a amené à dire des conneries qui étaient tout à fait indignes de lui. Et évidemment qu'un personnage de roman qui serait représentatif d'une catégorie sociale serait un très mauvais, enfin serait le personnage d'un très mauvais roman. Bon, je ne vais pas répondre à votre question, mais ça tourne autour quand même.
Well, I guess I'm thinking in particular, there's some passage at the beginning of Paper Tiger where your protagonist who's driving around through the course of the novel is remembering his political activity. And I'll just read a very short passage of that. The partisans warn. No, cut that. Bombastic. We inform the henchmen and the imperialists that their skullduggery will not go unpunished. Yeah, skullduggery. Obviously, that's not used much anymore. But it's one of those old worlds that contains some anger, some defiance. Maybe worth resurrecting. You always have been in favor of uniting the old and the new. You don't see much difference between Joan of Arc and Louise Michel. That makes you suspect, could cause you trouble. But what can you do? Let's skip here a little bit. You were struck, obsessed rather by what you saw, all the while pretending not to look. On the left, just after the bookshelves piled with a collection of books on the Spanish Civil War, the Resistance, Cuba, the October Revolution, the Black Sea Mutiny, the Algerian War, China, Vietnam, anarchist unionism and other edifying subjects, not banished for sure. After this quite typical preamble or vestibule, well, do you know, you ask 13's daughter, Kuno-san, and on. It seems to me there's very much a satirical view of radical politics. And so I guess when I say a political novel, rather than a novel that pushes a political viewpoint, I mean a novel engaged in politics. And maybe this is something where an American reader and a French writer are separated, because frankly, a political novel in America is a rare bird indeed. And so just for it to confront politics at all seems like, oh, it's a political novel.
Oui, mais pardon, je suis gêné. Je suis un peu gêné que le. Enfin, c'est vous qui choisissez. Hein. Mais que la conversation se focalise sur ce thème du roman politique. Quand j'ai écrit ce livre dont vous venez de citer un extrait, qui parle en effet des années gauchistes, enfin des années 68, disons, ça n'est pas du tout pour... ça n'est pas pour transmettre une espèce d'héritage, ça n'est pas pour dire... par exemple, pour dire aux jeunes de maintenant, faites pareil, ça n'est pas non plus pour leur dire ne faites pas pareil. En tout cas, voilà, le sujet dont je parle, l'époque dont je parle était une époque politique, mais la volonté d'un écrivain, me semble-t-il, la volonté d'un romancier, c'est pas du tout de transmettre un héritage ou une leçon. Un écrivain, ça doit simplement essayer de faire comprendre comment les choses étaient. Ça doit essayer de faire sentir comment les choses étaient. Mon dessin, quand je... Ce que vous avez cité, là, c'est un type qui est en train d'essayer d'écrire un tract. Je voulais simplement faire sentir combien la langue était embarrassée, combien la langue était paralysée. C'est tout ce que je voulais faire sentir. C'était pas dire l'action politique c'est bien ou c'est pas bien.
Now, this is good, because I think we just hit on something which is potentially really fruitful, which is Olivia is describing as a novelist trying to depict in fiction how things were and how they felt for political activists at this time. And I think that Edgar, particularly in the novels where you take on these sort of grand American subjects and fictionalize major figures from American history, there's a similar project underway to try to understand how things were and how they felt, but how they were and how they felt is centered around figures, sort of the figures on Mount Rushmore, as it were. Is there anything we can do to that?
I find myself not feeling right about the way this conversation is going.
I apologize for that.
No, not at all. I mean, the Book of Daniel, which I published in 1971, is considered a political novel based on loosely the trial and execution of two married couple who were convicted of giving the secrets of the atomic bomb to the Soviet Union. And I think it would be best for me to try to explain what I said before by getting a little personal. This book came to me in the late 1960s, when something called the New Left arose, came up out of the college campuses. And I was intrigued because it was nothing like the old left of the 1930s when I was a child. The old left was Marxist, theoretical, sort of dominated by the Soviet Union, and there were varieties of left-wing behavior, all of either people either enthralled to Stalinism or taking exception to it. The New Left was anarchic when it began. It was domestic, it had no foreign influences. It later split up into various sects, and there were some Maoists, and there were some democratic socialists and everything, but it was characterologically different, at least at the beginning. And I began to wonder about the history of radical thought in the United States and what happened to radicals. But I didn't have a story. And then in the late 60s, I I remembered the case of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, and then I had a fulcrum, a way to connect the 30s to the 60s. And the way to do that was to speak in the voice of a child whose parents are executed for espionage. And so that's the way the Book of Daniel came to be written. But I had trouble when I started, because I started writing in the third person. And one day I read about 100 or 150 pages of my book, and they bored me. And I was in great despair and threw the pages across the room. And almost in mockery of my pretensions as a writer, I put a fresh sheet of paper in the typewriter. That's what we used those days, we used typewriters. And started to write something that turned out to be the first page of the Book of Daniel. And what I had stupidly taken 6 months to figure out was that I shouldn't write the book because I didn't know anything about these people. But Daniel should write the book. And the key thing was that he could be intimately involved with everything that happened to his parents and yet not know what was going on. So he absolutely duplicated my situation, where I didn't know really the truth of any of this. And so the discovery I made was to have a child who's intimate with the situation, but totally with no control over it. Now, what I'm trying to describe is what writers go through, and I think my colleague would recognize this kind of thing. You don't begin with any great, at least I don't, political intention. Your book begins from the smallest kind of evocative, private excitement of the mind. In this case, some sense of a way to tell the story of 30 or 40 years of my country's life by means of its radical elements. And this is the way writers think. I mean, I've written other books that have begun from just the sound of words. I wrote a book called Loon Lake because I was driving up in the Adirondacks Mountains and passed a sign that said Loon Lake, and I loved those two words together. But for some reason, they excited me, and a whole novel came out of that. But when you write that way, all sorts of things can happen. You can write a linear narrative, very easy, very accessible. You can end up with some sort of collagist book, which I've done, in which the tension is achieved from discontinuities. Now, the Paper Tiger, which you quoted from, interests me not merely because it's a kind of an elegy, a remorseful, regretful elegy for the botched 1960s, for the mess that people made of the 1960s, but technically because of the daring quality of it. It's almost done totally as montage. There are very few scenes in this book. It's done as a monologue where this man is trying to explain to the daughter of one of his late radical friends what happened to them in this group called The Cause. And they're driving around Paris all night as he's trying to explain things. And his mind wanders and digresses, and there, what holds the book together are several leitmotifs, images of Che Guevara, images of the narrator's attempt to go to Vietnam, where his father was killed when the French were fighting there, images of the botched attempts at assassination or kidnapping. And these things are returned to over and over and over again. Now that's what interests me when a writer breaks the rules and digresses and interrupts the narrative line to jump around into some other subject entirely. And you hear the voice of a book like that, and you realize that nothing could be written unless you have a voice. The voice precedes everything else, precedes all intention you may have. You have to have the diction, the voice, the language first before you can write the book. So it comes out of this kind of process, and that is why a discussion that begins with the politics of novel writing seems to me to be to miss the point, if you pardon me.
that is fair enough.
Puis-je ajouter quelque chose? Complete effectivement. Je suis tout à fait d'accord avec ce que vient de dire Edgar Toff. On ne sait jamais à quoi ça sert la littérature. Et d'ailleurs, ça n'est pas une chose utilitaire, ça n'est pas une chose qui répond à un besoin strictement défini. Mais en tout cas, si ça sert à quelque chose, ça sert d'abord à être beau. Ça sert d'abord à faire aimer la langue. Bon. Et ce qui est important d'abord dans un livre, c'est en effet sa voix, sa singularité, l'usage particulier qu'il a de la langue. Voilà. Je ne veux pas tout le temps faire des citations comme un prof, mais il y a aussi cette histoire de Flaubert qui disait qu'il voudrait écrire un livre sur rien, c'est-à-dire un livre qui tiendrait simplement par la beauté des mots. Bon, c'est plutôt ça qui est important dans la littérature que ce que ça prétend transmettre comme message, etc.
Okay, so the question of style.
So,
how much time?
Question of style.
How much time do we have left?
20 minutes.
20 minutes. There's something that I know. I'm going back to politics, which will annoy the panelists, but
no, go.
There's an address that Edgar gave for a conference on the theme of the public good, which was sponsored by the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and the American Philosophical Society in 2007, and it was published in The Nation. And its subject was George W. Bush's war on knowledge. Yes, to boil it down. And there was one quote that really struck me as I was reading it, and this is it. The president we get is the country we get. With each elected president, the nation is conformed spiritually. He, or she eventually, is the artificer of our malleable national soul. He reposes not only the laws, but the kinds of lawlessness that govern our lives and evoke our responses. The people he appoints are cast in his image. The trouble they get into, and get us into, is his characteristic trouble. Finally, the media amplify his character into our moral weather report. He becomes the face of our sky, the conditions that prevail. So this image of the president being the face of our sky, and the image the conditions that prevail, and the writer existing under it was very poignant to me. And I guess I kind of I know you both made it very, very clear, and I certainly sympathize that, that questions of style, questions of language, questions of phrase like Loon Lake are really what ultimately you're thinking about when you're writing these symbols on a page, and when you're hearing them over and over again in your head, and when you're spending years on a manuscript, and it's held together in your head, and it's held together on paper, and the things that get you through it are these formal questions, because that's what you're concerned with first and foremost as a writer. But the sky is filled with the present. And I guess I just, and since both of your novels have political content, it seems to me that the sky being filled with the president is significant. And I wonder how aware of it you are as you work. Maybe Olivia should go first. I mean, does President Sarkozy fill your sky? And Carlo Bruni, perhaps?
Non, pas vraiment. Il est très petit, vous savez, d'abord, il ne peut pas remplir le ciel. Non, mais donc le président Sarkozy ou autre ne remplit évidemment pas le ciel. En revanche, je ne sais pas si j'ai bien suivi l'histoire de ce président. Dans les nuées, mais ce qui remplit le ciel, enfin, ce qui est notre malheureusement notre horizon écrasant, oppressant, etc. C'est la langue, comment dire, dégénérée. C'est la langue qui ne veut plus rien dire. C'est la langue sans couleur, la langue sans singularité, sans relief, la langue sans goût, la langue qui est un tissu de lieux communs, la langue qui n'est faite que d'expressions toutes faites et qui n'est faite que de pensées toutes faites. Bon, et cette langue-là, c'est pas simplement la langue de nos présidents, souvent, mais c'est aussi la langue des médias, c'est aussi la langue de la télévision, c'est aussi la, etc. Et là encore une fois, dire, bien sûr qu'il y a des émissions meilleures, etc. Bon, il y a des bons journalistes, on a ici. Bon, mais ce contre quoi on a à se battre quand on écrit, c'est ce que Mallarmé appelait l'universel journalisme, c'est-à-dire une conception de la langue qui est simplement un moyen de communication, un moyen d'information. Ça remplit le ciel, et l'idée que la... Enfin, ça obscurcit le ciel. L'idée qu'un roman, par exemple, c'est simplement une histoire, une chose qu'on doit... une histoire qu'on doit raconter, une chose qu'on doit transmettre, une information qu'on doit donner, une analyse même de la société qu'on doit donner, c'est une chose un peu, enfin moi, pour moi après c'est une chose un peu oppressante, c'est une chose un peu, c'est un peu contre ça qu'il me semble qu'il faut écrire.
The key line there, I think, it has nothing to do with the sky. It's that the president we get is the country we get. I think that's inarguable. And we all suffered 8 years under George Bush, and we were a totally different country in his tenure from what I hope we're starting to become now. Of course, writers do live as people as well. And they do find themselves in a political context, you know, all the time. And that's a truism. In the 1930s in the United States, there was a movement of proletarian, a series of proletarian novels written. Some of them with the aesthetic, from the aesthetic principle that a novel should be a collective, it should be collectivist, it shouldn't be personal, it should be about groups. And so, a lot of bad books were written in the 30s, proletarian novels, but a few good ones were. I think John Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath came out of that tradition. Richard Wright's Native Son, even John Dispasso's The USA Trilogy, reflected the 30s sensibility of so many writers who were aware that things were really, really bad. After all, the First World War, Great War, was, in the words of Woodrow Wilson, supposed to make the world safe for democracy, and then these people woke up and 1933, 4, and half of Europe was under dictatorships. Italy, and Germany, Spain, Portugal. And people were broke and starving. How could a writer not somehow respond to any of that? So I don't mean to say that I wasn't saying that art shouldn't be political. I'm just saying that we mustn't forget that the serious novelist has to respect the nature of the occasion of the novel and abide by its demands, which are organic. And whatever intention you begin with very often changes during the course of the writing. And I just wanted to make that point that we don't write propaganda, we don't write political tracts. There's something else going on. We don't have followers. Novelists don't have followers, and they there was a time when writers had followers, and that was in the Bronze Age, when writing was prescriptive and categorically demanding. But we writers today don't have followers, and we shouldn't. What we have, and the more of us there are, the better the society is. What we have, what we offer, is an independent witness, and if it's any good, it will last. Why are we talking about this? It's not what I want to talk about. We mustn't get too pompous about it. I mean, it is a noble profession, there's no question about that. But we should stick to our lasts and not make too much of who we are and what we accomplish.
Olivia, do you feel a similar humility about the practice of literature?
Humilité. Je veux dire, la seule chose que je connaisse un peu bien, c'est, que je connaisse en tout cas charnellement, directement, etc., c'est j'ai commencé à écrire. Bon, la seule chose dont je puisse parler de façon véridique, en tout cas, pas forcément de façon éclairée, mais de façon véridique, de façon sincère, de façon... où aucun après, aucune pause ne se glisse, c'est de cela. Bon, donc on peut en parler avec une certaine assurance, mais d'un autre côté, c'est vrai que le discours pompeux sur la littérature, le discours, tout ce qui fait apparaître le travail littéraire comme une espèce de mission, ou comme un sacerdoce, ou comme un prophétisme, ou tout ce qui surestime, tout ce qui fait de l'exercice de la littérature, de la pratique de la littérature, une activité au-dessus des activités humaines normales, me paraît détestable, pompeux, ridicule. Donc, vis-à-vis, enfin, de cette façon-là, en effet, oui, il faut être modeste.
Yeah, well, I think
on sait, on sait ce qu'on fait. On peut parler avec une, encore une fois, avec une certaine sincérité et quelquefois une certaine conviction, une certaine profondeur, etc., de ce qu'on fait. Mais ce qu'on fait, par exemple, ne nous donne pas, toujours sur cette politique, mais ce qu'on fait ne nous donne pas une voix plus haute, une prééminence par rapport à d'autres, par rapport aux autres hommes ou aux autres femmes. Un écrivain n'est pas un super homme. Un écrivain n'a pas vocation à diriger l'opinion, etc. Contrairement à ce qu'on pense quelquefois.
No, I think I just think what's very clear is that novelists speak by writing novels, and the transaction that means the most is what happens between their books and a reader. So in a sense, maybe a panel like this is a kind of torture device for the novels. And I apologize if I have been in the applying presuppositions. But anyway, I hope you enjoyed that. Thank you.